Welcome to another episode of Cosmic Echo, a Taylor podcast. In this podcast, we explore the bizarre phenomena that happens in our lives when we sleep in altered states. In this particular episode, we get to speak with James Kent, who is the author of The Pit Theory, otherwise known as the Psychedelic Information Theory. James has a wealth of knowledge when it comes to the psychedelic experience and understanding the science behind it. James provides us an alternative view into how the psychedelic experience is actually generated inside our minds. If you enjoyed this podcast and would like to hear more, we encourage all our listeners to please visit our website at taylors.com/CEPodcast, and there you can listen to additional episodes, as well as join our Patreon page and support this podcast. So without further ado, let's get to the interview.
How are you doing today, James?
I'm doing pretty well, thank you.
Thanks, and thanks for joining us. So James, before we get started into the pit theory, can you give us a little bit of background about your experiences in writing as well as your work into psychedelics?
Yeah, okay. Well, first of all, I've always been, even as a kid, I've always been fascinated by things like optical illusions and how our brain perceives reality. And I would do little tricks with my brain, like looking at things with double vision, crossing my eyes, doing long-distance staring, and trying to see if I could make reality become something different than what it was supposed to be. And so I think my fascination with psychedelics probably started long before I even knew what they really were. And then at some point, right about at the age of 20, when I was in college, I got the opportunity to try LSD for the first time. And it kind of triggered in me a lot of these things that I knew about optical illusion and kind of making my brain do tricks like lucid dreaming and that kind of thing. And I became very fascinated with how they worked. And so I got into the scene, I got into the psychedelic scene, and because I was a writer and an editor, I began first as an editor for a magazine called Psychedelic Illuminations in the 90s. And when Psychedelic Illuminations went under, I published my own magazine called Trip Magazine.
Okay.
And then towards the end of Trip is when I started to write Psychedelic Information Theory, because I had kind of gone through everything in the popular scene and decided that there wasn't enough kind of scientific material on perception out there. So I wanted to make a contribution and kind of gather up everything that I had learned over the years.
Okay.
And put up kind of one unified theory of hallucination, and that's where Pitt came from.
Oh, great. I guess we can get started into your Pitt theory.
Mm-hmm.
So get into Pitt. Pitt seems to be pretty advanced theory with many different types of references and terms that I think most of the psychedelic community may not fully understand. So my goal with this interview is to give you your version of Pitt in such a way that hopefully the general population can understand it. So with that, how did you get the idea of Pitt?
Well, it first came to me as a new way of kind of understanding psychedelic hallucination. I had kind of come to the conclusion that most of the theory out there focused more on the content that was created as opposed to how that content was created. And my goal was to study the brain to see how, by just adding one small molecule, suddenly you can generate all this new information. So the process of generating new information under the influence of psychedelics, to me, is the most important thing to understand. Mm. And the content of psychedelic experimentation is kind of secondary to understanding that first part, because the content is subjective for everyone.
Mm-hmm.
But the process of generating information is the same for everyone. So I think that's what people really want when they take psychedelics. They want to kind of go to that well of imagination where new ideas, novel ideas, novel perspectives pop out.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, I think, why people experiment with psychedelics in the first place.
Right, yeah. It seems like most people want to see images and have some type of content from the outside. Is that what you're saying?
I think people are kind of, when they go into psychedelics, I think they're kind of looking for something.
Okay.
Something that's beyond their scope of knowledge, right? Because that's mm-hmm. fascinating for people. That's kind of a, you get a high when you learn something new, or when you're confronted with something that's confounding. And I think a lot of people really value the creativity that they mm-hmm. get out of psychedelics, and they value the ability to spontaneously change their perspective about themselves or about people they know or the world, and kind of create a new identity. And that newness, that new identity, that new perspective, the new ideas, the new art forms, the new writing, the new clothing and design, all of that comes out of this experimentation of trying to get the brain to produce novelty beyond normal imagination.
Okay, so getting into Pit a little bit more, can you give us a little brief overview of exactly what the theory is itself?
So the simplest way to describe it is that the brain and the consciousness and perception exist in many stable states. There's, you know, you could be awake and alert, you can be relaxed and introspective, you can be asleep and dreaming, mm-hmm. you can be asleep with no sensation. Okay, so there's a spectrum of consciousness that we move from one to another, and it remains really stable. And because it's stable, our perception of reality is hard and seamless. You know, nothing, everything is where it should be. What Pitt says is that all hallucination in the brain, no matter whether it's from a chemical or physical trauma or some kind of yogic technique, all hallucination in the brain starts when the pieces of the brain that connect perception start to lose communication with each other. And when the various areas of the brain that handle perception lose communication with each other, there are gaps in the reality that is coming in. And when there are gaps in that reality, the brain automatically starts to fill in the missing details. Now, this is kind of what happens when you're dreaming, is your brain fills in a whole reality to cope with sensations that you're having while you sleep.
Okay.
And when you take psychedelics, you may be standing awake and alert, but because there's those gaps in your incoming perception, because your brain is kind of decoupling, the various areas of the brain start to amplify and lay over each other, trying to fill in those gaps. And a lot of the same processes involved in dreaming and imaginary recall go into filling those gaps. So the dreaming part of the brain creates a smoothing process over the noise and distortion that's caused by the brain decoupling.
Okay.
So that is really kind of the central piece of it. And if you can just get that piece, all the other details in Pitt are just explaining how that happens.
From
a pharmacological standpoint, from when the drug hits the receptor, how the different areas of the brain start to lose timing with each other, and what that loss of timing means for how we then parse perception.
All right. So going off from there, in your words, what is consciousness made of?
Well, consciousness is kind of, I think, a term for an aggregate of sensation. To me, consciousness, when people talk about consciousness, it's almost like they're talking about only one state of consciousness, which is being awake and alert. And to me, there's just a wide spectrum of states that the brain can be in, that we move through every day. So consciousness is a process that that moves from being super alert and super engaged in reality to completely detached and gone, flattened. When you go into deep sleep, consciousness pretty much disappears, and all that's left is this autonomic, biological, process that keeps you alive. But consciousness is gone. It disappears. So to me, it's when the brain is up and running and we've got our memory online and we've got our perception online and we're able to behave and interact with reality, I think that's what most people consider consciousness. Mm. And to me, that's only kind of one little tiny piece of it. But I don't like to use the word consciousness too much. I like to use words like perception or self-awareness.
Okay.
Because those are a little bit more descriptive than consciousness, which is this kind of, you know, it can go, it's a philosophical concept almost. Mm-hmm. It's not really definable.
Okay. In your theory, I was reading about it, and it just went in depth in the consciousness and what it's made up of.
Mm-hmm.
So
yes. So there's perception is really kind of what we think of as consciousness, but there's also memory. There's the ability to recall memories. There's behavior, and there's a feedback between all of these processes. So you don't just behave. You don't just create behaviors out of nothing. They're generated by perception. And how that perception bounces against pattern matching in your memory and recall.
Mm-hmm.
So when perception comes in, you bounce those perceptions against memory and recall, and that triggers behaviors, whether it's an emotional response or a physical response or an internal thought. That's a behavior. Mm-hmm. Then those behaviors bounce back into perception. So you've got perception, input, pattern matching, memory recall, behavior, and then behavior feeds back into perception. So it's a feedback loop.
Okay.
Okay.
So while you're thinking a thought, you don't lose the thought in mid sentence, because the loop keeps going. The thought continues. Mm. If you break that feedback loop of consciousness, suddenly you lose where you are. You forget where you are. That's kind of what senility is. Is when you start to lose that feedback loop on where you are and who you are,
okay,
and what
okay.
you're doing, and you forget.
That makes sense.
Yeah. So that's kind of what I see consciousness is that feedback loop through all those layers of perception and memory and behavior, and then looping back in on itself so
okay.
that you can keep the train going.
So it pretty much perception, you touch, you feel, things like that, and then it creates a loop kind of in your mind. Is that what you're going at for consciousness being like a
yeah,
constant?
Consciousness is that feedback loop. And when
okay.
you lose
okay.
the feedback loop, consciousness sort of disappears. Self-awareness disappears, and all you're left with is kind of raw sensation.
Okay.
And that is one aspect of psychedelic, experimentation. You can get to a point where the brain, the modulation in the brain, the serotonin modulation in the brain, is almost cut down entirely, so the feedback loop never actually closes on awareness, and it's just this open-ended raw sensation where there is no time, there is no self, there is no memory, it's just sort of being.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's crazy. Is that something that happens over time, or is it something that happens every time that you...
When you take psychedelics?
Yeah.
Well, in psychedelic literature, it's called ego loss.
Mm-hmm.
They call it ego loss, where, and it's also kind of a mystical notion. It's in Buddhism and a lot of yoga and meditative practices,
right,
where you want to reach this state where the self disappears, and you kind of transcend that idea of being, constantly looped in a goal-oriented behavior.
Right.
And you sort of just let that all slip away, and suddenly you're just immediately in the moment with no preconceptions. Now that's, even though it's a mystical notion, there's a very biophysical element to the way the brain slips out of that self-referential loop and becomes open-ended like that.
Mm-hmm.
And and that has to do with the 5-HT system, the way serotonin modulates the forebrain, which is kind of the center of our rational self-awareness.
Mm-hmm.
And when psychedelics interrupt the communication to that area, because they stick to the same receptors, the serotonin, you get this, you get, like I say, holes, you get a distortion and holes in the self-referential loop. And the brain can either smooth over those holes and try to make wild tangential assumptions about what's going on, but at deeper layers of that, it just slips altogether, and it's like you're in a waking dream.
Yeah, I mean, I do a lot of lucid dream work and stuff like that, and talk with people that do lucid dreams, and it sounds a lot like this happens during the same thing happening during lucid dream states is
well,
the
loss of
ego kind of thing.
It's the opposite, because the dream starts with the loss of ego.
Right.
But it only becomes lucid when that self-referential loop comes back online. So when you're in a dream, your rational forebrain is shut down, because serotonin is no longer modulating the brain. It's being modulated by acetylcholine, which slows the brain down into this more dreamlike imaginary maintenance area, like a trance state.
Okay.
And all of the activity from the brain is coming from the hippocampus and the medial areas of the temporal lobe, which are like the emotional centers and the memory centers and memory recall areas. So in order for you to dream and have that kind of really, really robust memory recall and concrete imaginal rendering, you need to shut down the rational forebrain. Because if the rational forebrain is online, all of that imaginary stuff slips into the background. And the brain does that for a reason. It has this switch that you can go back from being awake and present and asleep and dreaming, because you don't want to be wandering through life looking around and trying to perceive reality and have your dreams being superimposed on reality while you're walking around.
Okay.
And psychedelics kind of hang that switch open, so you can be awake and superimposing dream images on top of what you're seeing. In dreams, the switch from the rational forebrain is completely off, but as you begin to wake up, the rational forebrain comes online, and for a little while there, you are lucid in your dream. And then, when the rational forebrain is fully online, you wake up and the dream ends. So, lucid dreaming is very similar to psychedelics, but it's starting from the dream and becoming lucid. Psychedelics is being lucid, and then tamping that down until the dream element comes forward.
Yeah. There's some people do like the wake back to bed technique, which is they're awake and then they go back to sleep, and then they experience like floating, they experience like a loss of self kind of, and then they're in the dream world, and then they're lucid. So in that sense, I could see how that could apply to the pit as well.
The hypnagogic state is really, if you look at the brain from a brainwave standpoint, there is a really discrete section between like 3 and 4 hertz, 3 or 4 cycles per second, where the brain is hung in that hypnagogic state, that trance state, where you are, it's usually laying down, eyes closed, but you are kind of in a dream, you're in that trance dream, and you can actually slip down into sleep, which is like 3 hertz or 2 hertz or down to 0 hertz to deep sleep. But then when you come back up to like 4 or 5 hertz, the rational forebrain starts to go into the alpha mode, which is kind of the relaxed reverie. And then you begin to wake up. But if you can just sit there and hang in that little tiny frequency range, you can lucid dream, you can be in trance, you can do this kind of body disappearing thing where you appear to float and the body becomes invisible. And it's, you know, that's kind of the goal of a lot of yogic meditation, is dropping right into that hypnagogic range.
Okay.
And psychedelics do that great. I mean, they're almost custom made for making those trance states happen. So it makes achieving things similar to lucid dreaming much easier than just trying to hold that state, bounce on that state naturally. You know, doing it naturally, you can make it last for a minute or two, maybe 5 minutes.
Right.
But you're always going to wake up. You're always going to keep waking up out of it. Psychedelics keep you in that state for hours at a time if you're meditating. You know, you just stay there, and then you just hang open in that space as long as you want until the drug starts to wear off.
Interesting. Yeah, I can totally see how that makes sense. Just a side reference, did you happen to read any of Alan Watts? Alan Hobson's...
Word? The Dream Drugstore?
Yeah.
Yeah, he was fairly influential. As I was starting writing Pit, there were a couple authors who were very influential. Hobson was one of them. He's the one who basically defined this chemical switch between mm-hmm. dreaming and waking, which is the acetylcholine serotonin modulation gating that goes back and forth between the hippocampus, the memory, and the rational forebrain, which is perception. And that kind of was the first, maybe not the first, but this first or second piece that I read that made me think that, oh, okay, there is a really easy way to define this. Maybe not easy, but all there right. is a biological way to define what's going on. Joseph Ledoux's Synaptic Self and Emotional Brain really kind of... I had a lot of assumptions about what the brain did, but I didn't really know anatomy very well. Mm-hmm. And after reading that book, I was like, okay, now I understand why I think those things. Mm-hmm. Learning the anatomy and learning how the emotional centers and the memory centers worked, plus Hobson's work together, led me towards, kind of putting together all the pieces on Pit and how the this imaginal process works.
Awesome. Yeah, I read the Dreams Drugstore as well, and that kind of inspired me into doing the same thing you kind of did with the. I did a couple papers on how chemicals interact in the brains, things like that. So
there's actually some interesting stuff you can do with Hobson's work. Is that if you do take psychedelics specifically for that really kind of explicit eidetic lucid dreaming experience, mm-hmm. you can pre-dose with supplements like choline or galantamine that stimulate acetylcholine production, so that when you go into that trance state, you have an amazingly rich experience. And sometimes it's so rich, it's beyond your control. This is like a biological reflex that happens. This dreaming engine, and when you kick that biological reflex into overdrive, you get extremely intense and just rapid fire imagery, photorealistic imagery. Hobson's work is more than just a theory. It's testable. You can go in. You can freak this gate between perception and dreaming, and it's all legit. I mean, the science works, and if you just pay attention to it, a lot of the way that the brain works in these states becomes more intuitive and obvious.
I never heard of it that way before. That's interesting. So more into the pit. What is the controlled interrupt model, and how does it apply to the psychedelic action, or what, what does that exactly mean?
Okay, so the controlled interrupt model. So we've been talking a lot about perception and consciousness as this feedback loop, and consciousness operating on various frequencies from alpha, beta, theta, delta. So this frequency of consciousness. From, let's say we're in a beta state, which is awake and aware. Mm-hmm. This frequency of consciousness is like a control loop. It's like a circuit running. It's like electricity running through a circuit. And you can see how fast the electricity is running through the circuit by looking at things like the brainwave speed, like 18 hertz, say, 18 cycles per second. That is the control frequency. That frequency is holding consciousness together. It's holding perception together. When multimodal perception comes into the forebrain, it all reaches the brain at the same frequency. And because it reaches the brain at the same frequency, reality stays bound. It stays together. Now, I'm oversimplifying that a little bit. Not everything comes in at the same frequency, but there's enough of an aggregate there between everything coming in at once, keeping it all bound within a reasonable frequency. there's dominant frequencies and subdominant frequencies, and brain waves are more complex than I'm making out right here.
Okay.
But generally, there is a dominant control frequency in the way that we're perceiving reality. The control interrupt model says that in order for hallucination to begin, you have to interrupt that control frequency. Hmm. Now, the most dramatic way to interrupt it is to knock somebody in the head with a baseball bat. It just completely disappears, right?
Right.
And then they hallucinate stars.
Yeah.
Or bright lights. But there's a wide range of subtle methods of interrupting that frequency before you get to that point of knocking it completely out.
Hmm.
So the control interrupt model says that hallucination begins by interrupting that control frequency. And if you take a drug that has a very subtle interruption on that control frequency that lasts over an 8-hour period, over time that subtle interruption will grow into this huge noise wave that just cascades over time until you're into this feedback loop of noise. So that kind of describes the methods by which drugs get into the perceptual system and then kind of hack perception by freaking that control loop. And the way they do that is with an interference wave. They create interference in the control loop that keeps everything from being synchronized.
Mm-hmm.
When brain areas start to lose synchrony, and there's distortion in the signal, then the dreaming part of the brain comes on and starts to fill in those gaps. So one of the metaphors I like to use for this is back in the old days when they were first making moving pictures, films, they would roll a reel to advance the film and a bulb would flicker for each frame. Now, when people watch movies, if they watch them for more than 5 or 10 minutes, this little gap between frames, the gap between flickers, which I'll call the dead space, people started to hallucinate faces in that dead space, which was the opposite frequency of the bulb flicker, right?
Hmm.
You have the bulb flicker on, bulb flicker off. Now, on, they're seeing the movie. Off, they're seeing these hallucinations in the dead space.
Weird.
Okay, so now, imagine you take a drug that puts 30 dead spaces in perception for every second.
Hmm.
So you get this tiny mild flicker in perception where you have these interrupts, these little dead spaces in the update rate of your perception.
Mm-hmm.
Now when that happens, the brain starts to do all sorts of stuff to compensate for those little dead spaces.
Mm-hmm.
And so the control interrupt is kind of modeling how drugs can interrupt the control frequency on various different frequencies to create different types of hallucination.
Okay.
And the kind of types of hallucination a drug produces are representative, they're exactly correlated to the frequency that they interrupt consciousness on.
Hmm.
So if a drug interrupts consciousness on a lower frequency, it'll produce a different kind of hallucinations than a drug that interrupts consciousness on a higher frequency.
Okay.
Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
Say, so that's the control interrupt model. And that is something that I came up with and have tested with various different drugs. And even though this is just kind of my own model that I cobbled right. together out of pieces, it appears to work for just about everything.
Hmm.
You know, mind machines that stimulate the mind with lights and sound, mm-hmm. or strobe lights,
yeah.
they're doing the same kind of thing. They're creating this off and on dead space thing. Now, the difference between a strobe light machine and a drug is that the brain creates the strobing in the neural, the drug creates the strobing or the flicker
mm-hmm.
in the neural network itself. It's not coming in through the retina or the ears. It's being applied directly to the neural network. And that's why you can't shake it off. I mean, you can't open your eyes and make it stop. You can't close your eyes and make it stop. When you're in that hallucinating state and your neural network is being interrupted and flickering like that, it stays in that state until the drug is metabolized.
Yeah. No, that totally makes sense. So if a little bit of my reflection of what you just said. So in consciousness is a constant flow.
And yeah, it's a feedback loop. It's more life. Like a gate. It flows upwards and then it flows back in. So
right,
it's,
so it's a yeah. It's a constant feedback, and it creates, you know, normal consciousness. And then when you alter that, what you're doing is you're creating, in a way, spaces in between the normal flow, and then your brain compensates by creating imagery or
in those
sensations.
Spaces. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, so it goes from a level of a very mild interrupt where you're only getting sort of like stuff appearing in the periphery, mm-hmm. to a very hard interrupt where you're starting to get more photorealistic images appearing with your eyes open, to a complete interrupt where you're on your back with your eyes closed and you're completely in this dreaming space.
And that would be like considered the peak of the drug, kind of?
Yeah, that would be the peak, when the interrupt takes over the control frequency and becomes consciousness. Consciousness becomes the interrupt frequency. Mm. Psychedelics remodulate the brain to their own interrupt frequency.
Hmm. Interesting.
And you can kind of shake that off. When you're in the peak, if you open up your eyes and you start moving your arms and legs around, the Mu rhythm that controls movement of your muscles and your limbs will override that interrupt, will override the interrupt of the drug, and suddenly your forebrain consciousness will come back online, because that control frequency has been interrupted. But the minute you sit down and sit still and become quiet again, the control frequency amplifies, feeds back on itself, and suddenly you're in the interrupt and you're not in waking consciousness anymore.
Wow.
So, yeah, it's always in training you towards that dead space.
Interesting. Totally makes sense. So, in your book, you talk about the pharmacology of psychedelics and stuff, and you described a little bit with acetylcholine 5-HTP. Is there, you know, can you go a little bit more into that, of how psychedelics affect that and what they bring to the table?
Well, yeah, the acetylcholine 5-HT gating really applies to tryptamine psychedelics, like LSD, mushrooms, DMT, ayahuasca, any of the tryptamines, because those are the ones that most dramatically alter the 5-HT system, the serotonin system, and kind of knock the rational forebrain offline. The other end of the spectrum is the anticholinergic drugs like Datura, Belladonna, alkaloids. They produce hallucinations the opposite way, by stimulating the acetylcholine response and kind of knocking the rational forebrain down that way.
Okay.
So you can either knock out the rational forebrain, or you can amplify the medial temporal lobe. And either way, you can kind of freak the way that gate switches. Now, interrupting 5-HT creates a different sort of hallucination than interrupting the acetylcholine. Doing the acetylcholine, anticholinergics, creates really dramatic dream states that are completely, disorienting. Like more like being in a delusional state, like a waking dream or a lucid dream. And other psychedelics are more like, they don't affect the 5-HT system as directly, but because they affect the rational forebrain, you do get similar effects. And because they do affect adrenaline, which is a big part of psychedelic experience that a lot of people don't talk about, they do have psychedelic effect, even though they may not be quite as hallucinatory. And I'm thinking more of the phenethylamines, like 2CB and mescaline in this category. They're psychedelic, but they're not as hallucinatory. And that's because they don't affect the 5-HT system the same way.
Okay.
And there is a target set of receptors that if you want a drug to be super hallucinatory, you target it to the 5-HT2A and 5-HT2C receptors, as well as the adrenal receptors. And that's how you make a really potent tryptamine, to get that really intense hallucination. And Dave Nichols' research with the Hefter Institute. You know who Dave Nichols is?
No, I don't.
Yeah, Dave Nichols pretty much has done most of the major research on the 5-HT2A and 2C in his lab, the Nichols lab. And most of my understanding of how that works comes out of work in his lab.
Hmm.
And he's the real authority on that.
Okay.
But yeah, that's kind of how, if you have a psychedelic that targets the dopamine receptors,
mm-hmm.
the psychedelic, the quote-unquote psychedelic effect that you'll get will be more sensual, and it'll be more adrenal, it'll you know, include adrenaline more, like there'll be rushes of sensation, as opposed to being like pure hallucination. But the control interrupt is still there. You can still feel the buzzing or the vibration or whatever it is that's going on in your body as it comes on.
Okay. So, you know, this is what I kind of reflect on what you said is pretty much different types of drugs affect different types of receptor sites, creating that type of gate in that experience or in our normal flow of consciousness, and then it interrupts it and it causes us to have hallucinations and different types of sensations because of that.
Yeah, so really to create hallucination, all you need to do is interrupt the forebrain enough. And different drugs do that in different ways depending on receptors they target. Like salvia divinorum and nitrous oxide don't target any of those receptors. But because they interfere with incoming sensation so dramatically, they create their own interrupt frequency and produce their own different types of hallucination, which are very different than tryptamine hallucinations or the hallucinations that you get on mescaline or ayahuasca or something like that.
Okay.
So So different receptors and different targets will create different types of control frequencies. And based on those control frequencies, those interrupt frequencies, based on those interrupt frequencies, that will dictate how hallucination is generated and the types of hallucination that you'll get.
If you enjoyed this episode of Cosmic Echo, please visit our website at www.taileaters.com/CEpodcast, where you can hear more episodes that we've produced. Additionally, you can donate to our Patreon page and help support the podcast as we continue forward. Thanks, and until the next episode, happy dreaming.